I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Yesterday, the CIA released its 1,000-page, 16-month report on Saddam Hussein's weapons programs and ties to terrorists. The bottom line, Saddam hadn't had weapons of mass destruction for over a decade before the U.S.-led war, hadn't passed any weapons to any terrorist groups, and had no intention to do so. In fact, the secular leader was hoping in recent years that Washington would be interested in making peace to counter other threats in the world. Joining us is Bob Drogan, national security reporter for the Los Angeles Times. And Bob, this isn't the first report on WMD, so why is it considered the most important?
It's the most comprehensive, Robin. This is the result of 16 months of work. Everything prior to this was given out and said to be a preliminary report. And the White House, President Bush, specifically chose Charles Dofer to do this and repeatedly said, well, let's see what Mr. Dofer has to say.
Yes. And during the presidential debate this week, Senator Edwards and Vice President Cheney went a few rounds over the issue of whether Saddam Hussein had contacts with al-Qaeda, whether he possessed weapons of mass destruction. Let's listen to Mr. Cheney.
The effort that we mounted with respect to Iraq focused specifically on the possibility that this was the most likely nexus between the terrorist and weapons of mass destruction.
Bob Drogan, in this report, was there a shred of evidence that any of the grounds for war, the aluminum tubes, the trucks purported to be labs, the material from Africa, any of that was true?
Well, the report does specifically refute almost every major claim that the White House and that the CIA had made before the war as to the weapons of mass destruction.
It does conclude, though, that Saddam Hussein wanted to make weapons of mass destructions again.
It's a little vague. It's a little odd. What it does is it says he had the intention to do so, but that it found he had no plans, he had no strategy, he had no staff, he had no infrastructure, he had no programs in place to do so. And it's a little unclear still whether Saddam Hussein told them this in his own debriefings or whether they have inferred it from the various things that people around him said because they believed it.
You write today about a new disclosure in the report, something that was discovered in March of this year.
Well, what they found, ironically, is that the only production, the only real effort to produce chemical or biological weapons in Iraq over the last 12 years came this year, and it was by the insurgents battling what were then the occupation troops in Iraq. They raided a souk in Baghdad and discovered a group that was trying to recruit former Iraqi scientists to build chemical weapons and possibly a biological toxin to use against the U.S. troops.
Bob, you've written a lot about this topic. Just in your view, how is this issue going to be handled in, the presidential campaign and the debates coming up tomorrow?
The Democrats obviously have seized this report to make the case that Saddam Hussein was not a grave and gathering threat. He had no weapons of mass destruction. He had not had any of these weapons, had not produced them for 12 years, and therefore they are arguing the war was wrong. The White House is taking the opposite view and saying, look, even if he didn't have them, he wanted them, and someday he certainly would have gotten them, and we couldn't really keep him in the box forever, and therefore the war was right. And the two sides have sort of squared off on those.
Yeah. Let's move away from Washington for just a minute, in the minute we have left, and see what this report tells us about Saddam Hussein. The story feels almost Shakespearean.
It is. You know, he's a fascinating psychopath, obviously, who, it turns out, one of the most interesting things I found was, it turns out Saddam Hussein knew precisely the status of his weapons programs. He was micromanaging it all along. And one of the theories had been, well, maybe, you know, this whole thing was because no one dared tell Saddam Hussein that we really didn't have chemical and biological weapons. And he went to war assuming he did. And oh, my God, that's why he, you know, crawled into his hole at the end. But it turns out he knew quite well. He brought his generals together shortly before the invasion and announced it to them and sort of shocked them, apparently, because they'd believed the mythology as well. So he was doing that. And at the same time, he viewed himself not so much Shakespearean. Ironically, he viewed himself as a character out of a Hemingway book, out of The Old Man and the Sea. He apparently identified with Santiago, you recall the book, the Cuban fisherman who hooks a marlin and then loses him to the sharks, but still sees himself as the victor because he comes out with dignity. So he is a man, obviously, of complexity. And when we see him in the trial, presumably we'll get further insights into his thinking.
Yeah. Bob Drogan, a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Bob, thank you.
My pleasure.
This week on the campaign trail, John Kerry took President Bush to task for limiting federal funding for stem cell research. Kerry, a practicing Catholic who wears a crucifix and attends weekly mass, characterized stem cell research as an issue of scientific reason, agreeing with the preponderance of scientists who say embryonic stem cells, derived from discarded embryos, are better at generating tissue than adult stem cells. President Bush frames the issue as a moral and religious dilemma. We'll have more on the collision of religion and science and how that affects public policy. But first, the candidates were asked their stand on a variety of scientific issues by the journal Nature. And Colin McElwain of Nature joins us on the line from Washington. Colin, let's start with your questions about weapon systems. Their opinions differ. First, what did President Bush say regarding new nuclear weapons designs?
Well, he made it clear that they would continue with the effort to support research and development into new designs, including things called bunker busters that some people at the nuclear weapons laboratories are interested in working on.
Mm-hmm.
The Democrats have long taken the position that it would be better for the nuclear weapons labs to concentrate purely on maintaining the existing weapons that they already have. There has always been a group in the laboratories who would like to do more than that, who would like to be involved in weapons basically that are smaller than the existing ones, and therefore one could argue more likely to be actually used by the military. And it's clear, as it was already clear from the administration's policy, that they would like to research these weapons. Kerry says in our questionnaire that he would scrap that program on new weapons.
Yes, he said, I would end the pursuit of a new generation of nuclear weapons.
Yes.
Well, President Bush is quoted, or his campaign is quoted, as saying, the evolving security environment requires a flexible and responsive weapons complex infrastructure. To that end, my fiscal year 2005 budget reflects an increase in weapons activities. What about missile defense systems?
Well, the difference between the two parties there has been very well established, actually, for about 40 years, because the whole concept of ballistic missile defense has long been regarded by the Republicans as one that has some political potency. In other words, that they will see that they will develop such a system. For a long time, a lot of physicists and also Democrat politicians have been saying, well, wait a minute, it won't work. And that argument has gone back and forth now, I think, since the 1950s. And now they are actually deploying a system, although there's a lot of controversy over whether that system actually has any military effectiveness or not.
But John Kerry isn't adamantly opposed to missile defense systems, is he?
He's adamantly opposed to the deployment of the system at this time when it's not, in his view, proven to be effective. In our Q&A, he took issue with the deployment at this time, but not with the idea of research.
I also wanted to ask you about the question that seems to be sort of the overriding one for many people about how a government deals with science. And it's the question of the recent charges of political bias against scientific panels. There seemed to be an increase during the Bush administration. Some people, for instance, I'm looking at an article where a George Washington University epidemiologist was quoted as saying, the system's broken and it's going to be hard to fix it. The charges were that the Bush administration were screening people who were to sit on advisory panels to make sure that they supported political decisions.
Yes, the thing about that is, though, that the system has always been broken to a certain extent. There's been a very direct attack on the Bush administration with regard to its treatment of these panels, but the American government employs a whole range of different advisory panels, and there's a spectrum of them, from the most politically orientated ones, the most powerful ones, which tend to be full of political appointees, all the way through to the most technical ones, which one would hope would be full of experts, and there's quite a lot of common ground in between. And these panels have always been subject to a certain degree of political pressure and political manipulation. The question is whether that has actually increased greatly under this administration or whether it's pretty well par for the course. I'm not satisfied myself that that question has been answered by Bush's critics.
Well, Representative Henry Waxman, the ranking Democrat on the House Government Reform Committee, has called for an independent commission to study the role of science and government, and to he said he was responding to charges from 20 Nobel Prize winners and major science organizations who claimed that the administration was trying to manipulate science to support administration policies, so he wants oversight. But in your question to the candidates on this issue, President Bush points out that his senior science advisor in the White House is John Marburger, and he's a Democrat.
Yes, that fact is maybe somewhat of a diversion in the context of perhaps about 1,000 panels that have to be staffed to provide advice or direction on all kinds of issues in U.S. policy, on everything from nuclear waste to the treatment of AIDS, every technical issue you can think of, really. So Marburger's political affiliation doesn't seem to be very major. The question is whether there's overall a greater level of politicization than has always been the case, and that, I think, is quite difficult to judge. It has always gone on.
One interesting question that I'm sure is of real interest to your readers at Nature, you asked about homeland security measures that could isolate U.S. scientists and endanger U.S. leadership in the field. Some foreign-born scientists who are interested in studying or doing research in the U.S. find it's harder now to get visas post-9/11. You know, both men cited the need to improve security and to improve the processing of visas. There wasn't a surprise there. But I wonder if you could just tell us about some of the concerns about scientists.
Yeah, this is a much bigger issue for science in America than I think most people outside the scientific community recognize. Science and engineering in the United States has always relied very heavily on immigrant talents. For example, in postgraduate students and postdoctoral fellows, that is young scientists who already got their postgraduate degrees, there's an exceedingly high number of foreign students filling these positions, particularly from China in science and from India in engineering, and we're talking about tens of thousands of people. There is this issue with the new homeland security requirements of whether this flow will effectively be curtailed and what the long-term implications for American leadership in science might be. And it's certainly true that top institutions in Britain and Australia are extremely optimistic that they will be able to get more good students from China and from other countries if it gets harder for people to get into the United States. So the whole question really is whether all of these sets of rules are going to damage the leadership, the ability to soak in global talent, which has been the main thing underlying the strength of America's top research universities.
Colin McIlwain is with the journal Nature. He and his publication submitted questions to the presidential campaigns about science. Colin, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And when we come back, how some on the religious right hope to affect public policy on issues of health and science. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. As George Bush and John Kerry are asked about their positions on issues of science, scientists are increasingly concerned about attempts by the religious right to influence science policy. Chris Mooney is a senior correspondent for the American Prospect and is writing a book about conservatives and science. He writes in this month's Washington Monthly that Christian conservatives have gone a long way in creating their own scientific counter-establishment. Chris joins us now. And Chris, you cite creation science as one avenue. Could you define creationism for us?
Creationism has multiple meanings, but essentially it's a religiously based rejection of evolution in favor of some form of divine creation of life.
Yeah, we remember Ronald Reagan saying in 1980, as you point out, that evolution was only a theory. But as you write, the Supreme Court ruled in 1987 that creationism could not be taught in schools because it promoted religion.
That's right.
But now you write, creationists do their research under the umbrella of something called intelligence design as well. Can you define that?
Well, intelligence design, I'm not sure they're actually doing research. That's the problem. They're claiming to be doing science, but it's not clear that that's actually what they're doing. Intelligent design is a set of arguments that the older creationists used to make about how living things look as though they've been designed for a purpose, and this to them implies that some intelligent being must have been involved in creating living things. Mm-hmm. For example, the idea that the eye is so perfectly designed for vision. And the notion is that this organ is so well designed that intelligence must have created it.
Well, and how does faith come into that?
the argument implies an intelligent designer, which of course is going to be God. And the people who are making this argument and claiming it's scientific are pretty much all conservative Christians.
Will you go on to talk about some people who are doing work in the field of, I guess, what you'd call faith-based science? David Reardon is one. Mm-hmm. What's his work?
He is finding correlations between women having abortion and them having negative mental health outcomes in later life. The trouble with this work is that there are a lot of confounding variables that he isn't able to take into account. So, the best psychologists say that he's not proving that abortion is causing women to have mental breakdowns. You know, women might feel anguish after an abortion, but in terms of long-term mental health problems, the evidence just isn't there.
So the science isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, some would say that the secularists on the left mm-hmm. haven't paid enough attention to emotional problems suffered by some women who've had abortions. So what's your particular concern about his work?
My concern about his work is that it appears to be driven by a religious agenda. In fact, he's written pretty clearly that this is going to be a way of ultimately overturning Roe v. Wade by showing that abortion causes all of these problems for women. And the science is not strong. The science has been widely criticized by his peers because of this correlation causation problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, in fact, women who opt for an abortion, they tend not to be married. They tend not to be in intimate relationships. Those factors, you know, are correlated with mental health problems. So it's probably not the abortion that's causing it. It's probably something that they, going in.
Well, you also cite the work of Joel Brind. Explain his theories of abortion.
Well, this is closely related to Reardon. It's part of this, what I would argue is the same strategy on the religious right. They believe that abortion is immoral and evil, and they've been making that argument for a long time. More recently, what you find them arguing is that abortion damages women, and this is a strategic move to shift away from making the moral arguments that not everyone in the country accepts to making a set of scientific arguments. The problem is that the scientific arguments aren't strong. The arguments that Reardon's making about abortion causing mental illness aren't strong. The arguments that Brind is making are about abortion causing breast cancer. And those have also been widely debunked by pretty much all of the experts in the field.
Yeah, he claims, and in fact he's written, that he thought it was the noble task that God had chosen for him to prove the biological connection between an abortion and breast cancer.
With all these people, if you track down some of their writings, you find the theological views starting to seep in, as if that they believe this is sort of, a God-given task to do this science.
But since no one in the scientific community agrees with him, the problem would only be if it affected policy. Has it?
Yes, that's the problem. It has affected policy. Some states are passing laws to require, they're essentially disclosure laws, which is if you go in and have an abortion, in some states, Texas is one of them, the doctor has to tell you there's a risk of breast cancer. This is a great way of deterring women from having an abortion, but it's not fair to tell them something that isn't true. And so, that argument is actually having a big impact.
In fact, you write, in 2002, Representative Chris Smith got the National Cancer Institute to change an online fact sheet?
Mm-hmm. To suggest, essentially, the science was considered closed on whether abortion causes breast cancer, and the science was considered pretty strong in saying that it doesn't. But what they did was they rejiggered the fact sheet to suggest that it was contradictory. This created a huge outcry, leading to another massive review of the science by the National Cancer Institute, which is part of the NIH. Sure enough, again, they said, abortion doesn't cause breast cancer. And so then the fact sheet was ultimately changed back. But, it's based on Brind's work that this change was made in the first place. He's the number one person who makes this argument.
Yeah. We're also keeping an eye on a story out of the Grand Canyon, a book, a creationist theory of the creation of the Grand Canyon, is for sale in the federally run bookstore at the Grand Canyon, and we're keeping an eye on that story as well. But you conclude your article by saying that science will undoubtedly rule out.
These arguments can be made, the ones that we've discussed. And they're being made, and politicians are adopting them and implementing them. And the Bush administration has shown itself highly sympathetic to these characters that I'm discussing. However, they remain on the fringe, and their arguments are not winning out, and they don't seem to be changing their minds in the face of strong refutation by the scientific community. These are the kind of ideas that if they do not stand up to scientific scrutiny in peer-reviewed journals, they're going to be cast by the wayside. That's how science works. They're going to be discarded. There might be a political moment today, but in the long term, this is not a winning strategy. Tobacco did it for 40 years, right, arguing about maybe 50 years, arguing, claiming that their products didn't cause cancer. But that strategy collapsed, and it was extremely damaging to the industry when it did. And this is the same sort of thing. You can't make a phony scientific argument forever.
Chris Mooney is a senior correspondent for the American Prospect. He's writing a book about conservatives and science. He's also a blogger, right, Chris?
Mm-hmm.
So we'll let people know how they can read your work. Thank you very much.
Okay.
And to read Chris's work, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Massachusetts is laying the groundwork for the first statewide network of electronic medical records in the country. Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts is pledging $50 million to test the idea. That's half the total federal budget announced this summer for similar pilots around the country. Here Now's Martha Biebinger has more.
Marilyn Burnham of Holden has spent 30 years managing clinic and doctor's offices. So when her husband developed mononucleosis and was referred to a specialist in Boston, she offered to take a copy of the medical record with her.
They said, oh, no, that they would mail them and then the doctor would have time to review them before we came in. And we got there and he couldn't find the letters. He couldn't find the x-rays. He couldn't find any of the lab work. He ordered all these tests all over again, which was a big expense. And we had to go back because he couldn't give us any information as to where he wanted to go from there.
Numerous studies, including one out of Dartmouth College 2 years ago, have concluded that 30% of the healthcare dollar is wasted, in part through similar patient experiences around the country. The inability to review a patient's complete record contributes to as many as 98,000 deaths from medical errors, according to a 1998 federal report.
The potential for improving quality from electronic medical records, I think, is fantastic, and the sooner we can get there, the better.
Lucian Leap, an adjunct professor at the Harvard School of Public Health, is an expert on patient safety.
Patients will get better care, doctors will be able to give the care more efficiently, and it'll be cheaper, and so the payers will benefit.
The momentum for expanding use of online records in Massachusetts has been building for almost a decade. Several hospital systems and research groups working on specific projects have set national standards. But the vision of patient records that would be computer accessible statewide in any emergency room or specialist office has been out of reach because most doctors say they can't afford the startup costs. Then in the spring, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts decided to spend $50 million to find out if the coordinated widespread use of computerized records would really cut waste and medical errors, as studies indicate. Chief Information Officer Carl Asenzo.
We just wanted people to focus on let's work together to make it happen. Let's not be worrying during the pilots on where the money's going to come from. And to date, that's worked out to be a very good approach, I think, for the entire group.
The group, the Massachusetts eHealth Collaborative, was incorporated last week. It will administer spending of the $50 million. The collaborative came out of a summit last year, called by the state's largest specialty physicians group, to gauge interest in expanding online records. Trustees include top executives from hospital networks, medical professional groups, health insurers, alliances of employers, and researchers in the field. It's what organizers call an unprecedented cooperative effort. Dr. Alan Gorrell is the acting chairman.
We've got the talent here. We don't need to invent it. We just have to get the folks who are doing these things to play in a larger sphere. If we can bring this up and down the food chain, not just to the most well-financed practices, but to all, then we've made a real quantum leap in realizing the dream.
Most of the $50 million will be spent on three pilot projects over 12 to 18 months. The collaborative is looking for communities where the vast majority of doctors, labs, clinics, and a local hospital would agree to change from a paper to a paperless system. That would include putting all patient records into the computer, reviewing test results on a computer, and filing prescriptions electronically. The collaborative would use the results to design an infrastructure that could be adopted across the state. Then the group would dissolve. But getting the 85 to 95% of doctors in Massachusetts who don't have or don't use such a system to sign on could be tough.
McLevin's office? Hi.
Stacks of paper, 4 and 5 inches high, surround the computer on Dr. Michael Levin's desk. Levin is a solo practitioner in Newton who has 6,000 or 7,000 patients. He uses computers frequently to review MRIs or lab results from the three hospitals where he is affiliated. But Levin says the standardized electronic record template, where doctors check off symptoms or problems, can be incomplete, if not inaccurate.
For example, this morning, patient with a clot in their leg, a cough, and a mass in their lung that needs to be biopsied, that doesn't fit nicely in a template. What it requires is a narrative, and the EMR system does not really encourage a narrative. And indeed, the EMR systems that I've seen skip some of the pertinent problems.
Levin worries that some doctors may contribute to inaccurate medical records by checking off more serious diagnoses or procedures that trigger a higher reimbursement rate. And he says electronic records might give insurers greater access to information Levin thinks should be confidential. Levin adds that he and many of his colleagues are generally wary of creating an electronic record system in collaboration with health insurers.
There is such a conflict of interest. The ideal care for a patient is doing an awful lot, and it's expensive. I don't think you can turn to the insurers and say, we've got the same interest. They have to make a profit, and they have to respond to the business community. The missions are different.
Some of the details about how medical and billing records would overlap have not been worked out, but organizers say the e-records will make billing more accurate. There would be the equivalent of electronic partitions to separate mental health information, genetic test results, or other material considered sensitive. The collaborative is not planning a central computer storage system for patient files. Instead, a doctor would be able to call up records from various hospitals or specialists as needed. The Federal Healthcare Portability and Accountability Act, or HIPAA, requires a patient's consent for the release of records and sets security requirements. But Jan-Laurie Goldman, director of the Health Privacy Project in Washington, D.C., says there are gaps in patient protection laws. One example, a terrorism or public health alert.
HIPAA gives the states a pass on public health and then says, you know, just adhere to the state public health law. So the states really need to be very active where state law is not sufficient, pushing to have stronger protections in place. We don't want to make people more afraid because we've developed a network that doesn't protect them.
Acting chairman of the collaborative, Alan Gorrell, says there are challenges to designing a system that balances greater access to records with patient confidentiality, but that finding the right balance is essential to the success of the project. Many doctors who are already using a computerized patient file system are pleased with the results. Dale McGee, a gynecologist practicing in Shrewsbury, is chairman of the Massachusetts Medical Society's Committee on the Quality of Medical Practice.
It hasn't reached the perfection that people expect, but in my opinion, it has passed the point of being better than paper records.
McGee and his partner spent $30,000 on the software and hardware for electronic records 2.5 years ago. He says while it takes a lot of time to set up and maintain the system, it has paid for itself through lower filing and transcription costs. McGee says the alerts when patients are due for or don't get follow-up tests, the ease of reviewing lab results, and the warnings about adverse medical reactions have all helped him improve patient care. The Secretary of Health and Human Services in Massachusetts, Ronald Preston, is a trustee on the new collaborative.
Most of the decisions that we have to make as it relates to the quality and the cost of health care are incredibly difficult. This is one of the few things that we can all agree to do that isn't difficult in the way those things are. It's really a wonderful potential and very rare in terms of the things that are available that can have a major impact.
Who would pay the $1 to $2 billion cost of creating an electronic medical infrastructure in Massachusetts is an open and volatile question. Doctors say it should be the insurers, because they'll see the savings, if there are any, from reduced waste and errors. Blue Cross and other insurers in the state aren't making any commitments. State officials say they'd consider helping finance the next step.
That report from Here and Now's Martha Biebinger. You're listening to Here and Now. Today, we hear part four of our five-part visit to the Islamic Republic of Iran with Vermont Public Radio reporter Steve Zinn.
My brother and I are on an aging train riding through the desert between the Iranian cities of Yazd and Isfahan. We're in a berth with three young men, Amir, Mohammed, and Hamid Reza. Amir, sitting next to me, speaks a few words of English. Mohammed doesn't speak at all. He just stares. Every time I look at him, I meet his dark and penetrating gaze. Hamid Reza, on the other hand, speaks volumes in Farsi. He's a big man with a loud voice and an explosive laugh. It's clear he's making jokes about us. He asks if we have any whiskey. He keeps asking for souvenirs, and that's making me nervous. It sounds more like a demand than a request. Finally, I reach into my bag and present them with three Vermont postcards. They stare at the pictures of big white farmhouses, red barns, and brilliant foliage, and they're thrilled. Amir passes out candy. I hand out maple lollipops. We pass around my Farsi English dictionary and share some laughs. Then Amir offers me his string of pale yellow prayer beads. I tell him I can't accept his gift. He offers them again. I say I can't take them. Again he stretches out his hand, and once more I decline. I'm observing an Iranian custom called taruf. A gift should be refused three times before it's accepted. So now I take the beads. As the train arrives, Mohammed's and my eyes meet. He's smiling and sucking on a maple lollipop. There's a saying, Isfahan is half the world. Isfahan is a city of surpassing beauty, with horse-drawn carriages in the square, leafy boulevards that hide the desert beyond, and tree-lined terraced sidewalks that wind along the Zayanda River, which runs through the city. Late on summer nights, families picnic on blankets spread on the grassy riverbanks. In the echoey recesses of the Kaju Bridge, young men sing traditional songs as friends listen appreciatively. The voices mingle under the 400-year-old bridge. Islam has inspired Iran's most stunning architecture. Everywhere there are mosques with their bulbous domes, slender minarets, and intricate blue mosaic tiles. Imam Mosque in Isfahan is considered one of the most beautiful in the world. We enter it through an ornate honeycombed portal. Inside, archways surround a wide courtyard and reflecting pool. Directly under the dome, sound reverberates eerily. A man demonstrates for us.
Allahu Akbar.
The call to prayer, the billboards with the faces of clerics, the buses painted with the phrase, "Don't forget God." They're constant reminders that Islam is both religion and government in Iran. One Iranian man tells me that to get a good job, you have to show you're pious and support the government. Your actual qualifications aren't that important. Another man tells me that unless he prays at work, he'll lose his job.
In this office, it is obligatory for me to say pray. I'm tired of this culture. I want to try another culture.
60% of the college students in Iran are women. Women vote, run for office, and pursue professional careers. But legally and socially, Iranian women have fewer rights and freedoms than men do. One night we have dinner with two young women who speak bitterly about these constraints. Despite their unhappiness with the government, young people we talk with are apathetic about politics because they don't believe things will change. They tell us they lead two lives in Iran, the one they have to live in public and a separate one at home. We talked to people who said they wanted to leave Iran for freedom, for jobs, and for education. But we also talked to those who said they couldn't imagine leaving. They expressed a love for their country that was touching and profound in light of the hardship of their lives. I witnessed it one evening when I listened to a group of young people sing a song that's become a kind of alternative national anthem. The official anthem of the Islamic government praises Iran's religious imams and martyrs. This song evokes the country's art and ancient culture. It celebrates a different Iran.
Our visit to Iran was produced by Vermont Public Radio's Steve Zinn. For pictures from his trip, visit our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. More ahead. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Ever since literary sensation Jhumpa Lahiri won the Pulitzer Prize for her collection of short stories, Interpreter of Maladies, she's been riding a fast track to literary fame. Readers connect with her stories of second-generation Bengali-American 30-somethings, and now one of Lahiri's stories moves to the big screen. Her best-selling novel, The Namesake, is being turned into a movie. Production begins in December, and it will be directed by famed Indian filmmaker Myra Nair. Nair's other works include Salaam Bombay, Monsoon Wedding, and Vanity Fair. The Namesake is now out in paperback, and last year Lahiri spoke about her novel and literary fame with Here and Now producer April Peavy.
It's not something I expect. It's wonderful. It's very, I feel very grateful.
What's so interesting about your writing is that so many people tap in to something that's in your writing, whether they be Indian American, Jewish American, and I'm wondering, what are you tapping into sort of in this 30-something American consciousness?
I don't know, you know. I mean, I don't think about these things when I'm writing. I don't think, oh, I want to tap into this or that or this kind of person or that kind of person. I'm just, you know, I feel like I'm writing from my heart and I'm writing a very specific kind of story. But what I would like to think is that these feelings, these emotions, these difficulties that I address are universal. I think that, you know, regardless of your background, you know, you can feel displaced. You can feel at odds with your environment. You can feel that you're betraying your origins or yearning for them or yearning for a person or a place. I mean, I don't think it's so much about geography or culture. I think it's more about how we are as human beings relating to each other.
I want to get to your new book, The Namesake, and the main character of Gogol.
Yes.
Gogol is not happy being Gogol.
No, not particularly. He's born in the United States to parents of Indian Bengali background, and he is at odds with who he is, and literally he is at odds with what he's called. He's named after a writer who meant a great deal to his father but means nothing to him, and the book is essentially about him trying to understand who he is and why he is.
It's a long journey for Gogol as he experiences what it's like being an Indian American. And I'm wondering, when you were growing up, was Jhumpa happy being Jhumpa?
No.
Did you like your name? Did
no,
you have a...
No, I didn't like my name. I could never forget that I was different somehow, that, you know, no one I knew had my first name or my last name except for my parents. And, you know, we didn't have any family in this country. And there were all of these signs that I contributed to a sense of isolation.
A lot of your stories seem so very personal. Are they personal? Because in many ways I feel like as I'm reading your book that there is a sense of you in there.
Well, I think there's a piece of me in everything I write. I can't imagine... I've never been totally absent from anything. In The Namesake, I've drawn more than I ever have on my own experiences, not in a specific way, but just drawing more generally on what it was like to grow up in New England in the 70s and 80s and have parents from a Bengali background, and just you know, the conflicts I faced, the issues I had, you know, growing up and wanting to fit into two worlds and feeling kind of that I came up short in both worlds. So all of that, I think, I've reconstituted in the namesake, in my main character.
And now you're married and you have a young son. What are some of the things that you'd like to pass on down to him?
I think a lot of what my parents passed down to me, but maybe not in the same exact emphasis. You know, I feel more comfortable in America than my parents feel. You know, so I'm going to be a different kind of parent, I think, to my son. I would still very much like him to know about and respect his backgrounds, my husband's family, my own family. My husband is an Indian, so there's a whole other set of cultures and traditions that all of which form my son. So I will teach him I'll try to teach him all of those things the best I can.
Jhumpa Lahiri speaking to Here and Now producer April Peavy. Lahiri's novel, The Namesake, is now out in paperback and headed for the big screen. And we'd like to note a passing before we go. Legendary Boston marathoner Johnny Kelly has died. Kelly, who started the race 61 times and won it twice, was 97. And joining us to just remember John Kelly a little bit is four-time Boston Marathon winner Bill Rogers. And Bill, I know we have listeners across the country who might even have seen Johnny Kelly in the coverage of the marathon, but why was he so wonderful a character?
I think Johnny was almost undefinable, you know, but he had a charisma about him that was special, and it was something to do with his running in the Boston Marathon. He just loved the race so much, and he kind of expressed that through his singing. His running, too, yes, but also his singing, and he would go out to the start of the Boston Marathon in later years, and he would sing the song Young at Heart, and to me, that was Johnny Kelly, and I thought he would last forever. You know, he was the Boston Marathon, and even though he was old, he was 97, I'm still shocked, you know, that he's died.
Yeah. A lot of people, the marathon was not over until you saw Johnny Kelly.
That's right. Yeah, he was, I guess it's a cliche to say a New England institution, but it's a fact. Mm-hmm. And he was kind of like that, maybe the way Ted Williams was here for years or something. Mm-hmm. But to me, he was more than a sports figure. You know, he was a special person. You know?
And how did he help you with your running?
I think he was inspirational, and that too is cliche, but when it happens and it's for real, and you know, the way he ran it till the age of 86, and he showed us all what a person can do as they get older.
I know that there's a statue at the foot of Heartbreak Hill. It's a grueling point in the Boston Marathon, I don't have to tell you, but it's dedicated to Johnny Kelly.
Yeah.
It's named Young at Heart, appropriately. Yeah. And I guess runners everywhere are thinking of him right now.
Oh, yeah, I think he's our Babe Ruth for the sport of marathoning, I would say. And it's tough when Boston rolls around in April. You know, we're going to miss him so much. But I think that statue, you know, his legacy, he made the Boston Marathon in good part, I think.
And that'll live on.
Yeah, we all appreciate that. He was a great person, great guy.
Bill Rogers, a running legend in your own right. Thank you for talking to us.
Thanks a lot, Robin.
About Johnny Kelly, two-time Boston Marathon champion, a man who Runner's World called the runner of the 20th century. He died yesterday in a nursing home on Cape Cod in Massachusetts. He was 97.
Fairy tales can come true. It can happen to you if you're young at heart. For it's hard, you will find, to be narrow of mind if you're young at heart.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Thomas Terry. Our web producer is Zach Christo. Our newscast producer is Lindsay Crudell. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again, Here and Now.
Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth to be young at heart? For as rich as you are, it's much better by far to be young at heart. And if you should survive to 105, look at all you'll derive.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.